3, 2, 1.
The History with Jackson podcast.
So hello and welcome back to the History of Jackson podcast, the podcast where we bring up-to-date historical research to you in an accessible and digestible way. Now today we're looking at something which is current politics, but it's also some really fascinating history, as we welcome historian and author John Rennie Short to talk about his book, and it is an awesome book, and a great cover as well, by the way, Insurrection, What the January 6th Assault on America Reveals About America, or Assault on the Capitol, sorry, Reveals About America and Democracy. How are you doing, John?
I'm good, thank you. Nice to be with you, Jackson.
Thank you very much for coming on. I'm, as people can probably tell, I'm super excited to talk about this topic, talk about this book with you. But I think the first question that I want to ask you is, you know, what inspired you to write this book?
A couple of reasons. One was very, very personal. I lived on 4th Street. So I was only four blocks. I lived only four blocks away from the Capitol. So it actually felt very, very personal. You could feel the rumbling in the city the day before the actual event. And then for literally months afterwards, we were on sort of like semi-permanent military lockdown. And that had been after a long summer of discontent with police out in the streets. So it was, felt that I was a sort of witness to something. The other thing I felt was there was a lot of commentary, but a lot of it was inside the Beltway, you know, as I said to the Treasury Secretary type thing, you know. And I didn't want to write one of those ones. I wanted to cast a kind of wider net and go a bit deeper, but also to make it accessible. I mean, you know, I'm originally from Scotland, and one of my sisters said to me, "What the hell is happening?" And so I think it's a response to that, especially for someone who lives outside the country. What the hell happened? Where did that come from?
I think that point there about what the hell happened, it was the same comment, same sentiment echoed across the world. What the hell's happening?
Yeah.
Certainly in what a lot of people consider the bastion of democracy in modern day.
Sure.
And your approach to accessibility really shines through in every page. And I really enjoyed that. And I love that you've tried to make this event and this moment accessible. Now, keeping the same theme of accessibility, what is an insurrection, and why is this, and we've kind of alluded to it a little bit, why is this such a big moment in American politics and American history?
I think it's a sort of one of the endpoints of incredibly growing polarization. Now, there's been polarized times in America before, but this is the first time in over 100 years that you've actually had a significant resistance to an authorized, honest election. People refuse to accept the legitimacy of the result. And that's scary in a democracy. And, you know, we have political debates in democracies all over the world, and they can get quite nasty and vicious, but people don't try to forcibly undermine an electoral result that was democratically agreed upon. And that's a worrisome trend, because what it then does is it breaks a barrier. If it hadn't happened before, it's now easier to imagine it happening again. What happens if Trump runs again, loses? And of course, if he loses, he will claim that it was stolen. And do we always get this? So there's a significant proportion of Republicans who believe it was stolen. Well, will they ever accept a legitimate election that they lose again? That's maybe doubtful. So in that sense, it's not just a significant moment in itself and what it represented in the build-up, but also what it auguries for the future. A reluctance to accept the result of democratic elections. And that cuts at the very heart of a democracy.
And I think it's that difficult moment of trying to balance what's happening for America, but also what's the impact of this of everywhere else as well, because democracy is a key staple of Western life, Western electoral life. But I think there's also another thing here as well, is that a lot of people have an idea of how American democracy works, but it's very different to how it actually works. So how does American elections work, but particularly presidential elections?
Sure. It's a curious thing. And the sort of key point, I think, for your listeners is that America is a very, very old democracy. Often it's portrayed as, oh, it's a brand new compared to ancient Britain or France or wherever. But in terms of its electoral setup, it's one of the oldest. It goes back 200 years. Britain, with parliamentary reform, changed and, you know, changes over the years. So these sort of older countries have much newer democratic systems. America doesn't. A lot of the things go back to the, you know, early 19th century, late 18th century. So, for example, we'll take the presidential elections. They occur on the first Tuesday, I think, in November, first Tuesday, Thursday, November, but the president doesn't take over until the 20th of January. So that almost 3 months. And that was a time, you know, that comes about when it was, people were riding horses around America. It took a while for the things to happen. And that creates an issue. The most obvious one is the Electoral College. Insofar as you go to the polls, you elect the president, but no one counts the popular vote. So if you get 25 million and your opponent gets 20 million, that doesn't mean you win. So Al Gore and Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. More people across the country voted for them than the persons who were made president. And it goes through this thing called the Electoral College, which is in each state is given a so-called group of electors, the numbers based on their population, and whoever wins the majority in that state is then declared the winner, and their electoral votes are then tallied up. Now, in the past, the difference between the Electoral College votes and the popular vote was roughly similar, if not, you know, in sync, but no longer. Now we have popular votes, but the Electoral College system that's kind of skewed. The other thing that happens is that the presidential election is not fought in a national campaign, really, but certain key states are important. Republicans don't, you know, do any electioneering in California. It's Democratic. Similarly, Republicans don't waste their time in Maryland, for example, or Democrats don't waste their time in the South, Alabama, Mississippi. We generally think that's given over to the Republicans. So there's only a key states. Florida would be one, the upper Midwest states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio. Those are key swing states because they're swing. They can go in either direction. And so most presidential elections are fought around those states. It also influences U.S. politics. So why is America so has been anti-Cuba? Well, Florida has a significant proportion of white Cubans, who left after the Castro took over. So the Cuban vote is incredibly important. The American Jewish vote, significant numbers of American Jews retire to Florida. Therefore, you know, if you need to win Florida to win the presidency. And so you cannot say anything against Israel, really, for those voters and become the president. Similarly with elderly people in Florida. It's difficult to do anything with reform of Social Security or form of pension because they're a significant voting bloc. Old people tend to vote more than younger people. So the presidential voting system in America is not a national thing, it's not a popular vote, it's key swing states. And we'll speak about that later, I think, when in terms of like what was the first insurrection. So this is like putting a pin and saying like, remember that it's the states that are key units for presidential voting systems.
I think that's some really nice context around the presidential electoral system, yeah. But also for this year as well, because this year is an important year.
Sure.
And
yeah.
It builds some context for people to understand that. Now we need to turn to Trump. We need to turn to the moments of January 6th. But what role do the media and lies play in allowing Donald Trump to rise to power and allowing him to create the conditions that allowed for the insurrection?
One was there was a sort of symbiosis between Trump and the media. So, for example, he was invited guest of the Washington Post at a dinner when Obama was speaking. You can't imagine, there's a Washington Post, considered liberal, invited Trump, and he was seen as a character, but not kind of dangerous. But he was seen as newsworthy, and he was a ratings machine. And so when he ran for the presidency, CNN in particular, basically gave him billions in free publicity. I remember you would sometimes turn it on and you'd be looking at an empty microphone with the, you know, rolling underneath, Trump will speak soon. He got acres of newsprint coverage and hours of television media coverage, but in a particular context. At that time, American media was still in the form of, on the one hand, but on the other. I said in the book, at that time, if you had like someone who said the earth was flat, you know, a reporter would say, well, let's speak to someone, you know, who says it's round and some, well, you make your own mind up. Actually, Jake Tapper, a well-known journalist, said, well, you know, it's up to the viewers to make their mind up. So there was really no pushback against just the avalanche of lies that came from Trump. So he was given free publicity. He was a ratings machine. Newspapers boosted the readership. You know, the right loved him, the left hated him, but everyone watched or listened to him. So he was this media phenomenon, and they just fed at the trough uncritically, given American sense. So he was a phenomenon that they had never really, you know, presidents lie, and but he lied at an industrial level. And there was never any pushback to that. The lies were also reinforced by new media platforms. So as the news system, ecosystem is breaking up, you no longer had the main channels dominating, you had a variety of different platforms. His wilder assertions were given more, more coverage. There's all kinds of reasons. One thing in media and the internet media in the United States is basically protected under a law introduced in the 90s. So they're not responsible for their content. So they could put all kinds of rubbish on and not pay a price. Similarly, there was all kinds of new types of platforms. So Alex Jones with InfoWars could just spew out absolute, I mean, really kind of disgusting lies about Sandy Hook. You know, the slaughter of innocents was a put up, a, you know, fake flag operation. And so you had that. So you had, you know, a kind of, you know, pliant media giving him free publicity. And he was seen as a bit of a joke, to be honest, amongst the kind of liberal elites. They didn't take him seriously, but his supporters did. And it was a shock to liberal America when he won. But it should have come as no surprise after the years of publicity. Actually, a key factor was his show, The Apprentice. So The Apprentice was this very popular show, and he played the role of a CEO and, you know, the leather chair and the, you know, the big office. And that showed him to be like a CEO in charge, you know, thing of a kind of masculinity. And then, again, he was given free rein with this. And people began to form attachments to him, you know, like as they do with any television star. They think he's their friend. So a whole mixture of media issues helped promote him and vaunt him into the presidency.
It's really fascinating to see how the media and the lies kind of merge into one. You have those big platforms, traditional news outlets, but those new media outlets, it seems like a perfect storm. But it's not just newness that brings a rise to Trump. There's also a long history that leads to him as well. You have Ronald Reagan and Sarah Palin. So how were Reagan and Palin, and I remember that election in 2008 or 2007 with Obama and McCain and Palin, how are they stepping stones to the path?
So the thing is, in the United States, there's only two major political parties. So the character of those parties, if they change, have significant effects. And the Republican Party will take the two names you mentioned. So Reagan introduces a sort of anti-government notion. At his inauguration, he said government is the problem. And you kind of thought, isn't that odd for someone running for the government? It's like, but that narrative of government, it cannot be trusted, began to become much more central to the Republican identity as time went on. It had been strong in the 50s with the right, you know, John Birch Society and more right wing, was kind of tamped down a bit, especially by the two Bushes, is one thing to notice. But Reagan introduces, the, again, a reinforced that sense, government is the problem. He didn't have the words deep state, but it was implied. And then McCain's running, you know, running against Obama, needs a sort of younger person outside the beltway, and he chooses a sort of populist. And so that opened the door to a sort of populism, which had been relatively weak in the Republican Party before. It was generally small government, big business. But Palin was the sense of, in order to stay relevant, the Republicans started to tap this populist basis, sort of anti-intellectual, anti-immigrant, sort of U.S. first sort of idea, lacking any foreign policy experience, but, you know, sort of like, I know what I know, and I know that, you know, America's great. And a sort of uncritical patriotism. So that kind of, those were steps. Bush can be seen as a change, but that's why he was unpopular amongst much of his conservative base, populist conservative base. And that came to the fore in 2008 with the rise of the Tea Party in the wake of the global financial crisis. So there's Reagan, a sort of government's a problem, Palin, sort of populism. The Tea Party comes into effect after the bailout and people got upset at government bailing out the big banks. And the Tea Party is this small government, government's the problem. There's a sort of conspiracy at work, sort of immigrants. And the Republicans, in order to stay in power or keep power or grab power, tap this populist base. So they, you know, kowtow to the Tea Party and they kowtow to Trump, as you can see to this level now. So even if most of the, senior politicians don't believe it, they're now, you know, they're strapped to the mast of Trump.
It seems to create this feeling of people and this foster this environment, people feeling left behind. Mm-hmm. How does that lead to a term that, which you mentioned in your book is democratic slippage? So how does that lead to democratic slippage and the insurrection?
Sure, a couple of things. One is it's important to remember that much of the middle class, and the middle class in America, slightly different from the notion of middle class in Britain, I think, is generally sort of like, it includes blue-collar workers, white-collar workers, includes people essentially who are not on welfare and who are not very rich, includes the bulk of the people. But they've had a hard time since the 1970s. Male, white, blue-collar incomes have not really risen all that much for 30 years. There's been a growing sort of squeeze on the middle class. The good years of American economic supremacy have disappeared. Jobs have been lost. American middle class have really had a much harder time. And remember, this isn't a country where there's no sort of great holiday system, you know, there's no paid leave for pregnancies, a whole range of issues. So when the private market begins to not meet their needs, there's nowhere for them to go in a sense. And in America, you're like, for many people, they're two or three paychecks away from oblivion with healthcare costs, educational costs. So there's been this rising discontent across the country, which actually reads to the election of Obama and Trump, by the way. We'll come to that later. There's a rising discontent. In the same sense that the political system seemed not to be responding to their needs. the Democrats, say, under Clinton, were all for globalization. Unwilling, I think, to accept the notion of like, okay, in the long term, everyone get better off. But in the short to medium term, where most people live, it wasn't all that good. Blue-collar America lost out of globalization. And the traditional Republicans were big business, free market. And well, the free market's great if things are going well, but not anywhere. And so I think for a large mass of people, they couldn't see any sense in which their needs or interests or worries were being reflected at the political stage. Combine that with the sort of rampant gerrymandering that takes place so that, you know, politicians get to choose their voters rather than the other way around. There was just a sense of like, it's going to hell in a handbasket. Add the fact that since 1965, immigration has increased. So like, you know, Britain and parts of Europe, there's a sense of like, especially for an older generation, economic conditions are getting worse, the political system's not responding to them, and there's more and more foreigners. So myself included, for example. So in that sense, there's this mounting sense of discontent that's not been given a platform or an opportunity to express itself. If you said anything about globalization in the 1990s, you were seen as an economic Neanderthal, right? Neither Democrats nor Republicans spoke out against it. It's taken a while for the discontent in America to be given, you know, some form of real political representation. So increasingly, people are saying, like, well, globalization will have to rethink that, offshoring jobs and need to bring jobs back home. But that's belated response, I think, to a rising impoverishment of the middle class or declining living standard, a perceived sense of declining living standards, increased immigration, and a political system that is unresponsive to their needs. Not even their needs, but even their basic sense. So if you travel around America, there's this sense that they just don't get it, those politicians. They're corrupt, they live in Washington, and there's enough, you know, institutions, but, you know, examples of corruption to back that up. But a real sense of growing crisis of legitimacy of the normal political system in America.
It's interesting to hear from a different perspective how there's still a lasting effect from policies from the Democrats affecting the electorate. And you mentioned a really interesting thread there about how it's something that both Obama and Trump have tapped into. Now, we tend to think of these two presidents, former presidents, as polar opposite men. But you, in your book, touch on their similarities. So how are these two men similar but slightly different?
Sure. Yeah, good question. They're obviously dissimilar in many ways, right? One black, white, one's meritocratic, one, you know, got wealthy the old-fashioned way, inherited it from his father. They're actually very different public performers. Obama could be cool but very empathetic when he needed to be or could be. Trump is the sort of wooden speaker. So you could go on about the differences. What I think is significant is both of them are insurgent candidates. What both of them did in different ways was appeal to that sense of discontent with the existing system. So if we looked at Obama, he had a very limited political experience, served in the Illinois legislature, was a senator for not all that long, still relatively young. But he was seen as a new, fresh face, and he had been against the Iraq war. Much of the existing political elites and senior political leaders had all backed the invasion of Iraq, including Hillary Clinton, most of the Republicans. As America, as you're 2000, you know, throughout much of the early 2000s, you know, Americans would see Humvees full of American, you know, young men being blown to pieces. It was seen as a fiasco. And if you had voted for that, it was very difficult to come back to the American population. Obama could. He had voted against it. The fact that he was black actually kind of appealed to him. He got more votes than many people realized, because in many places, people wouldn't say they were going to vote for him, but did. And he won significant in the upper Midwest, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio. He won outside of the traditional liberal California, New York, Maryland, for example. And I think it was because he was new, young, fresh, untainted by politics, normal politics, and had stood up. Trump was exactly the same, an insurgent candidate with no political experience, and that was the attraction. The fact that he wasn't a run-of-the-mill politician. The fact that he did speak his mind. The fact that he would say what was often unsayable for many politicians. That gave him a touch of authenticity. And so there was the... And he did get, obviously, kind of race vote, but there were significant numbers of people who had voted for Obama and then voted for Trump. I think the other thing was his opposition was Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and two things were a strike against her. One was the fact that she's a woman, and there's a tremendous kind of misogyny in America about politicians. Always has been, probably always will be, as far as I can. And the second thing, it sounded like a dynasty. Clinton, we had Clinton for 8 years, and now we're having another Clinton. And many, I think if you looked around the world, people will put up with things, but not dynasties. So, for example, Bush's brother, Jeb Bush, ran for the presidency. And actually, he was a stronger candidate in many ways than George Bush, who won. But I think the fact that he was a Bush, do we want another Bush? I don't think so. Actually, I think the same thing happened in Egypt, for example, a slightly different circumstance. But the thing was that the president, Mubarak, the feeling in Egypt was, he's going to give it to one of his sons. And there was that outpouring. People thought, oh, no, we're not going to carry on with this. And so I think the Trump was a... outside of politics, the fact that he was wealthy, he didn't try to hide that fact. There didn't seem any sense of, he played on that. I'm rich. I know how these guys, work the system. And the fact that he had a sort of freshness in a sense of like authenticity. I think it was a fake authenticity myself, but many people believe that's because I'd never watched The Apprentice, but many people believe that. So Obama and Trump, polar opposites in many ways, were insurgent candidates who appealed to the sense of wanting a big change. In the case of Obama, the problem was that he didn't able to enact enough change, and the problem for Trump was he enacted all kinds of bad changes. But so both of them were insurgent candidates chosen because they were outside the norm.
And it's good to correct that misconception that these two men are similar and they have similarities in why they were elected and why they're popular. And what I'm hearing a lot on that is that there's a suspicion and an aversion to the political elite. And something that relates to that in the path of the insurrection is QAnon. Now, I think this phrase is this big, mysterious kind of organization, but what is QAnon and what role does it play in facilitating the conditions for the insurrections?
So firstly, the name, Q was supposed to be the code word for a senior politician who was giving out bits of information, crumbs almost, across the internet. He did it anonymously, hence the QAnon. As we worked out now, it probably was like two pig farmers in the Philippines that were responsible for this. But what they did was to start to say, it was a classic conspiracy theory that America is prone to. There's a whole body of work. There's all kinds of reasons why it's prone to conspiracy. But all conspiracy theories have a certain thing. They have a sense of like, for you and me, the world is a complicated place. All kinds of things are happening, trying to make sense of it. Conspiracy theories, no. It's very understandable. There's a big story. They won't tell you. I'll tell you the big story. Everything is connected to everything else. And we're going to be in on it. I'm going to let you become part of the elect who know this. And QAnon's basic thing was that there was a cabal, a favorite word amongst conspiracists, by the way, all over the world. There was a cabal of democratic politicians and media figures who sucked the blood of children, who had sex orgies, and who were out to overthrow the American way. Trump was operating a secret war against them. And he was going to kind of expose them and bring it all to an end. So Trump was almost like a Superman figure. But it was obtuse enough that everything seemed connected to everything else. So, you know, there was a Mueller inquiry into Trump's connections with Russia, for example. According to QAnon, Trump knew that. He encouraged the Mueller inquiry because he wanted it all exposed, and then he was going to turn it around. And I had a friend of a friend who was a QAnon believer, and they had like different dates. Well, on March 14th, it will be revealed that, you know, whatever, fill in the gap. And when it wasn't, that's because there was a deeper plan at work. So you could never, ever get to the end. Now, what was interesting is how that infected both the Republican Party in general. Something like about 30% of registered Republicans believed QAnon, most of QAnon. And actually, Trump retweeted at least 250 times QAnon tweets. Or information. And if you looked at the imagery of the attack on the Capitol, there was more QAnon flags than American flags. It was a significant part of the narrative that brought people to Washington and to actually invade the Capitol. This sense of there was an evil cabal at work undermining the American way. Trump was the standard bearer, and we should do something about it. And by the way, you're in on it. You now know how everything is connected. The normal press will not cover this. They're part of the system. And there was this thing that was unverifiable, right? It was always unverifiable, and that gave it its continual usage. And it appears in odd ways again and again. So last year, I think there was a hearing for a Supreme Court justice, Ketanji Brown. And the Republican senators started asking her for hours and hours about her treatment of child molesters in the legal system. And hers was no different from anyone else. But what it was a call out to those still QAnon supporters and Republican supporters that they were on their guard against, you know, a Democratic nominee for Supreme Court being weak on, you know, child abuse. And that's a conspiracy narrative that echoes down the centuries. You know, it was Jews who killed young children and raped them and drank their blood in medieval Europe. It's again and again. So it's a classic narrative. But QAnon did inform both the Republican Party in general and a significant proportion of the people at the insurrection itself.
It's almost unbelievable to see how such a small, what started off as a very small conspiracy, has infected almost every step of the US political system. What role does the COVID-19 pandemic have on increasing this polarization?
Sure. I think the COVID was for everyone is sort of traumatic in many ways, right? It was a change from the existing system. It threw everything askew. Everything was up in the air. It was a time of uncertainty, and often in times of uncertainty, people, you know, there's an ache to uncertainty, and people want something to cure that or provide some balm for that. And a conspiracy theory provides that. The other thing I think that happened during COVID was a couple of things. One was the mandates about vaccination or closing public spaces. There was some resistance all over the world to that. But in America, with this long tradition of, you know, the government is bad, you know, don't step on me, it generated even more kind of anxiety. And there was all kinds of demonstrations, a famous one in Michigan where the state governor had said, you know, we need a lockdown for a certain amount of days. And people started protesting with guns. They turned up, the Michigan militia turned up with guns at public events. And that amped up the temperature throughout the summer of 2000. There's all sorts of demonstrations. And then there was a COVID plus the Black Lives Matter in the wake of the death of George Floyd. And so there was this incredible anxiety, tension, people out in the streets, guns in public places. And that's something I was acutely aware of living in Washington, D.C. in that summer. It was a long, hot summer of discontent, army out in force, people demonstrating, guns in public display in cities across America. It was a turbulent time. It was a time of turmoil, which sort of fed into the sense of like, it's all going to hell in a handbasket. The election's been stolen, COVID. It's all became this sort of rich stew of conspiracy and danger and uncertainty. I think people miss out on that because they forget about that summer, the COVID, the Black Lives Matter, the riots, the confrontations. That's all forgotten. And suddenly, you know, it's just the insurrection just appears on January 6th out of nowhere. But that summer of 2020 was significant.
I think that you made a great point there, is that we tend to look at the big moments in history without looking at the factors that create those conditions to allow that to happen. And now that we've looked at the factors that have led to the insurrections, and a key word there, I'm saying insurrections, that I'd like to discuss the boiling point now. And you mentioned in your book that there's two insurrections, which is against what people popularly believe. A lot of people believe there's that January 6th one, that was the insurrection. But what was the first insurrection and what happened during it?
So the first insurrection appears very early on. So presidential results are in early November. Trump refuses to believe them and says there's a conspiracy at work. Now, he has a long history of doing that, even for elections that he's won. He won the election fair and square in 2016, but he lost the popular vote. And he was incensed by that he set up a voting commission, which eventually abandoned. There's nothing there. But so he complains even when he wins, if he's not seen as a complete winner. What happened with the senior, more experienced advisors? They said, well, just give him time. He'll get round. It's like treating him like a teenage kid, right? It will give them time to get over it. And they leave as they're trying to get other jobs. So he's stewing, and then there's various other characters appear. Giuliani is one, a few others. And they hatch this plan. They say, well, we think the election was stolen. So the first insurrection was a way to overturn the result by, and this is where we come back to that point I made about it's at the state level. They said, well, you should say that that the election was stolen, turn it back to the states, to the state legislatures, to do a rerun or a recount or a revote amongst the state legislatures. In other words, it was going to discount the votes that had taken place and say, so one part of it was to do phony electors. So these group of electors, they weren't the real ones, started saying, no, we're the board of electors for the state of Michigan, and we say that it's Donald Trump. Well, they tried to do a sort of administrative coup, a sense of like overturning the popular vote by turning it back to the states so that the states would recount. The famous phone call to the Georgia Secretary of State, where Trump said to him, just find me a few more thousand votes. So that was, so they thought they could do it by turning it back to friendly states, Republican states, to overturn the vote, find new votes, to do a recount, or at best for them to give it back to the state legislatures and say, well, this is, you know, unfair election, tainted election, you guys get to vote. Well, state legislatures, you know, in the Republican areas would have voted for Trump. And so they only complained about states that Trump lost, not where Trump won. And so this was an attempt, and that carried on all the way through till late December, plus various court cases, legal system, you could do that. But there was an illegality involved, fake electors trying to change the votes, trying to get sort of like whole groups of people taken off the electoral voting roll, saying they were illegal, aliens, whatever. In that sense, that was that first coup. They thought they could turn the vote back to the state legislatures, who would say that Trump won, or say that Trump should be elected, and that was going to happen. By late December, it was clear that wasn't going to happen, that the states, they couldn't, you know, the board of the phony electors had been discovered. It wasn't going to work. There was some talk of one of his advisors, Flynn, Michael Flynn, said we should call it, we should call it the Insurrection Act, declare the election illegal and call in the troops. Now that was seriously considered. That was like half thinking about another coup. So the first coup was an administrative one, trying to get the election turned over. When that didn't happen, and it wasn't going to happen, they pinned their hopes, or at least a number of advisors said, well, you know, our last hope then is on the 6th of January, by convention, by the Constitution, the vice president declares the results of the electors. The box is brought in with the votes of the board of electors of each state. They count them and they call the results. It's formulaic, it's standard procedure. And one of his advisors, or a group of his advisors, said, well, what you could do is to get the vice president, who's the constitutionally mandated person, tell him to say that he wouldn't accept it because it's illegal, and we'll throw it back to the states again, or we'll, you know, or we'll declare another election, or we'll just throw enough dirt into the water so it's all confused and Biden doesn't become president. And Pence was asked to do this, and he refused. He said, I can't do that. I don't have the legal authority. And so what the march was about, that was quickly assembled, was to put pressure on the Senate in particular, at Congress in general, Senate in particular, and on Vice President Pence, to not go ahead with that count that showed Biden was the president. So this, the second insurrection, was those people turning up to physically make that possible, either to make Pence, you know, not, you know, make the not do the normal procedure and say, you know, Biden is president, or to put enough pressure on the senators and congresspeople to not accept that. And there were some, Ted Cruz, for example, senator for Texas, was going to, you know, actually a number of, 6 or 7 senators put up a resistance to calling the roll call for the different states. So the second coup was basically the physical invasion of the Capitol. But there had been this coup attempt to undermine it administratively, and then this was the last gasp.
And what actually happens during this last gasp? Because that first one is very shadowy, but the second one is very bright. Yeah.
So we only found out about the first coup, over the months that transpire, right? As the documents are released and people start saying, and people have to, you know, provide evidence and whatever. The other coup is really quite dramatic. So he calls the march. He said it's going to get wild. You have to turn up. I think he felt that it was So maybe about 15 to 20,000 people show up. And he tells them to go and march on the Congress. And I'm not, wasn't exactly sure what he was going to do, but a sense of like put pressure on Pence was the main thing. Now, before he does finish his talk, there's other groups involved, the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, and the Three Percenters. And those are a hardcore. So there's maybe out of maybe say 20,000 people roughly, there's maybe 500 to 1,000 are hardcore insurrectionists. And they turn up with tasers and, you know, handcuffs. And they're, what they want to do is cause disruption. And some of them, the Oath Keepers, basically their plan was enough disruption that would allow Trump call up the Insurrection Act, to call in the troops, call in the army, and declare the election null and void. So often, so there's two strains of thought. One is often Republicans, well, it was just a group of tourists, right, who were turned up, right? They just got lost, right? Though, interestingly, some of the tourists had like 900,000 volt stun guns, not the usual thing you wear in Washington on a January, right? But it's probably wrong to say that all of them were, you know, the hardcore insurrectionists. There was quite literally a hardcore. There's a wonderful video of the steps on the East Building, the steps on the east side of the Capitol, and the lots of people milling around, and then you just see this hard line of people in hardened goggles, helmets, flat gear, the gloves, and they're walking single file. And they were the real insurrectionists. Their plan, I think, was to capture Pence or Nancy Pelosi. And if they had have done, who knows what would have happened in the melee? What would have happened if they had killed Mike Pence? What happened if they had assassinated Nancy Pelosi? We kind of think now, many Americans think, oh, it's... yeah, it's whatever, really. But actually, we were unbelievably close to a major constitutional crisis. You know, there's some of them were crazy enough to have actually done real harm to Pence if he hadn't been evacuated. So they broke in. Actually, they started breaking in before Trump had finished. They break in, and then there's a couple of hours of melee. And it took a while for it to be brought under control for two reasons. One was Trump didn't do anything. He actually thought this was his supporters at work, and you know they're good people. Eventually, the most he could say around about four was to go home, good people. The other thing is refers to the nature of political power in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is not a state in its own right. If you're a state in your own right, like, say, Michigan, Louisiana, you can call out the state guard. The governor has the authority to do that. In Washington, D.C., you can't do that. You have to go through the Pentagon. And the Pentagon was very worried about the optics of sending troops in for initially for a political rally. I think the point I make in the book is also I think there was a bias. If it had been young black people, they would have called the troops in like 30 seconds. But this was middle-aged white folks. Those were our people. Those were ordinary Americans. And so it took till about 5 o'clock before, you know, so they'd start breaking down the doors about 1 o'clock. It took them about 4 hours to get the whole thing under control. And then they eventually did, and then the Congress is brought back into session. But even then, even after that, 167 Republican congressmen and about 6 or 7 senators still voted not to affirm the election of Joe Biden.
It's such a moment where, as you're saying, there are different people trying to combat their own biases and trying to perpetuate this image of America that they think is the image that everyone wants to see whilst inflicting damage on that political system. Now, there's very real evidence and scars of this insurrection actually happening at the Capitol. But what are the scars, you know, the impact of these two insurrections on the American political system?
One is there's an ongoing denial, I think. Nothing to see here. They were tourists. It was a minor thing. Nothing bad happened. Let's get over it. It's not, they don't see it as a major issue, I think, in the sense of, because to do so would be to question Trump, to question the direction of the Republican Party. There's too much invested in move along here, I think. You know, that idea of there's nothing to really to see here. Just, the danger is numerous. One is significant numbers of Republicans believe that the election was stolen. They still believe that. And if they believe that, as I think I said at the beginning, what that means is there's unlikely to be ever an election that they lose that they will accept as legitimate. Now that you've crossed, you've broken through that, over that bridge or through that window or whatever metaphor you want, something, you know, you've crossed the Rubicon. Now elections are no longer won or lost, they're stolen. That creates a sense of increasing polarization. So that's one thing, the sense of like the elections are losing their legitimacy. Because if you lose it, it means, well, it was stolen. That's the basic agreement that you undertake in democratic societies. If you lose, you just accept the loss and try to win the next time. When you don't do that, then you're down a very dangerous and dark road. The other thing is the Republican Party is still enthralled to Trump. And while that lasts, I can't see any, his personality, his whole persona is invested in the sense of that election was stolen. And if he gets into power, it's going to be payback time. So what you would get, I think, is a perpetual round of recrimination and sorts of bloodletting with each new administration. That would be one danger. Now, in some sense, you needed to do something with Trump, I think, because he had broken the norms. But Republicans see that as an attack on them and their party and their beliefs, and they feel very justified. If we get back to power, someone's going to pay a price for that. And then you're in a continual tit for tat. It's the Hatfields versus the McCoys in a political stage. And that could last a generation. Is it unwinds and unfolds. So none of it looks well for the health of the Republic. The other thing is, I think, also the incredible loss to the soft power of America. The sense of like, so if America stands up and says, you know, we're for democracy, people would just show them the clip. Really? Honestly, that's what or the notion of like, does any other country in the world want to adopt American electoral college system? I don't think so. Or lifetime appointments for Supreme Courts, or for a wait from, 3-month wait before your president comes in, or like all sorts of things that the American Constitution, you know, is integral part of the American Constitution. No one wants that. America is no longer, or even if it's still to some extent, is basically being devalued in the world's eyes as the home of democracy or a place where democracy flourishes. And what was really scary was even before the insurrection, I do work in Southeast Asia and geopolitics, and I'd be at events where there was Chinese academics, and they were using the phrase, that's fake news, that's political correctness. In other words, those things can enter the global lexicon. And so, for example, Bolsonaro in Brazil modeled himself on as the Trump of the tropics. Urban in Hungary, all sorts of people kind of get that playbook. And then it affects a sort of, it reinforces a populist trend, a populist authoritarianism. And that's so America has been projecting populist authoritarianism, I think, rather than functioning democracy. So it's come at a tremendous cost to the political system and also America's reputation, both at home and abroad.
I think that's a really nice really nice way of summarizing it, really, is American reputational harm, but also its impact on leading to other like-minded figures. Now, that was a really, really lovely conversation, John. I really love talking about the insurrections and the different factors that affected. I think it was a great study in how to conduct history as well. But I have a final fun question, as I do for all the guests here on the History of Jackson podcast. Now, as you've just alluded to, you do geopolitical work and you've written several other books on maps, which I think is absolutely awesome, and also human geography. But what is the most interesting map that you've come across in your work?
It's a map based on a particular projection. It's called a cordiform map, C-O-R-D-I-F-O-R-M. And it starts to appear in the 16th century as map makers, there's a sort of big cartographic revolution, and they work out they can do things with projection. So the grid of latitude and longitude, they can play with it mathematically. And so they can do all kinds of things, you know, change it around. And Oronzo Fine is best known of this, a French cartographer, created a map in the projection of the human heart. And so it's a map of the world as a human heart. And I tried to look into it in some detail. I've written about the history of cartography. And there's all kinds of wonderful theories about it. One, they were messing around with the projections, and it's part of this time of, you know, new work being done, innovative work, guys playing around. But there's also a sense of like, well, the human heart became a symbol of a group of people, Rosicrucianansi, I'm mispronouncing it, but this sense of the sacred heart, a sort of secret society of like groups of intellectuals trying to promote a sort of much more humanist order. Whether any of that's true is another matter. It's kind of open-ended enough. It's my own kind of conspiracy theory that I'm attracted to. So this notion of like this cordiform map projection appears, Oronzo Fine, F-I-N-E, and other cartographers. And then it kind of disappears. People don't do the human heart anymore. But it's just and when you see them, or the other one, sometimes they do a double cordiform, two human hearts, and do a double polar projection. And those are just wonderful because for a couple of reasons. One is it's technically interesting as to how you show the world. Secondly, it's a time of innovation very early on, 16th century. And the third thing has this wonderfully mystical kind of magical sense that you can't quite get to the bottom of. And so it leaves it an open-ended mystery. So I like the things where there's still questions that to be asked and never answered. Like it's like a kind of quest. So yeah, so that's my go-to favorite map.
That's an awesome answer. I'm going to have to go and Google that afterwards as well, because it just...
So punching cordiform map, and then you think, wow, yeah, oh, that's what it looks like.
You've opened my mind now to another area of historical discovery. Now, people are going to want to go away and grab a copy of your book, but also interact with you online. Mm-hmm. So where can they grab a copy of Insurrection, What the January 6th Assault on the Capitol Reveals About America and Democracy, but also interact with you?
Sure. So I think it's available in Britain now, I think, and all good bookstores. And it's remarkably cheap. I had no, but I think it's $18 or £18 paperback. And nice print size. So I've sometimes had books and you work on them and it comes back. You think, oh, I don't like that print size. Because as authors, you don't get much of a choice with this one. But Reaction did a wonderful job. And they also did a great cover, I think. And the book is really a nice feel to it physically. I think all good bookstores, you get it from Reaction directly. But Amazon, it's freely available. And you can contact me on my – I have a – website, johnrennieshort.com, and you can contact me, my email from there. And if you go to the website, you will see the other work that I do and other things about me. So that's johnrennieshort.com. And I tweet, but not so much because I'm trying to wean myself off Twitter.
Yeah, I can understand why. Well, I'll make sure a description, a link for the book is in the description below so everyone can go and grab themselves a copy. But also a link for your website is in the description as well so people can go and interact with you and look at your other work. So thank you very much for coming on, John.
Jackson, it was wonderful. You asked some great questions and allowed me kind of space and time to go on. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for listening to this latest episode of the History of Jackson podcast, where we spoke to John Rennie-Short all about his book, Insurrection with Reaction. This was a fantastic episode. I absolutely loved having the opportunity to discuss the January 6th insurrection with John and discuss the different factors that led to it, the first coup, and then the second actual event at the Capitol building. Now, if you enjoy this episode or any of the other content that we create here at History of Jackson, be that our social media or the blog, please do consider heading to the Buy Me a Coffee profile in the description below or subscribing to History of Jackson Plus on Apple Podcasts. Without further ado, I will leave you all to enjoy your day or to listen to another episode. And next week, we have another awesome episode lined up, so keep your ears peeled for that one.